From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time magazine, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo went to Ankara to push for Turkey to halt its offensive in northeastern Syria. The results are being called a ceasefire and a success by the Trump administration, but many outside the White House have a very different take. The procession continued of current and former U.S. officials testifying to House of Representatives lawmakers, conducting an impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump's foreign policy with Ukraine, and Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney held a stunning press conference in which he admitted a connection between political gain and foreign policy that President Trump had denied for weeks. The 12 Democratic U.S. presidential candidates took the largest stage in modern debate history, and the focus was squarely on the new frontrunner, Elizabeth Warren. Leaders from Britain and the European Union say they have reached an agreement on revised terms of Britain's withdrawal from the EU, but major hurdles remain before it would be implemented. And we'll get quick takes from our panelists on a range of subjects, including President Trump's choice of venue for the 2020 G7 summit and the passing of U.S. Congressman Elijah Cummings. Panelists, welcome. It is a very, very busy day. It seems that we're getting news that normally would come in a week that's coming in a day. And it's just a few days since all of these things have happened. So let's jump right into the U.S., Turkey, and Syria situation. One of the most startling turns in U.S. foreign policy in a generation, I believe, when Donald Trump ordered the withdrawal of U.S. troops from northern Syria, leaving the Kurds behind. And he is scrambling to justify this move as critics from both parties stand in fierce opposition. Molly, I'll start with you. Where, in fact, does Turkish military aggression stand now? Is there, in fact, a ceasefire?
It's unclear at the moment. The Trump administration yesterday declared that they had made a deal, but the Turkish government immediately came out and said that was not the case, that they did not consider it a ceasefire, and that any withdrawal would be a brief and temporary one in order to allow the Kurds to leave. It's not clear if the Kurds are willing to leave, if they want to leave this territory where they have been under attack. And overnight, we heard some fresh reports that there is fighting in the area. So it would seem that even if there was a ceasefire agreed to, it is not being observed. And this, of course, raises a lot of questions, not only about the administration's policy, but about what has been going on in these discussions and whether we have an honest partner in the negotiations.
Tom, President Trump says it's a ceasefire, and that is, it is, among other things, a great moment for the Turks, for the Kurds, and for the history of civilization. In fact, your broader thoughts on those comments.
Well, who knows whether any of that is true, but it's certainly not a great moment for civilization. It's very rare in Washington where a president can do something that kind of heaps scorn on him from all sides. This is a rare instance where many prominent Republican leaders, especially in the Senate, have broken with the president on this one. And the foreign policy experts on both sides of the political aisle are all saying this is not good for civilization, not good for the Kurds, not good for the Syrians. But it does suggest to me that it's good for the Russians, because the Russians and the Iranians have something which they have always coveted, which is more influence in a volatile part of the world and a volatile region of Syria. And the United States is pulling back. And I think the president's declaration of instant victory is a little, shall we say, premature.
You touch on a very important point, Tom, which is like qui bono benefits from this entire thing. And you touched on it too, Molly, when you said, well, we don't really know what happened in the conversation, which it seems to be the only conversation, President Trump's conversation with President Erdogan, that preceded this action. How is the Trump administration positioning this, that it is a win in any way for the United States?
Well, the president has positioned this decision as part of his America First ideology when it comes to foreign policy, saying that the United States is involved in too many entanglements overseas and that the troops should be brought home. That message is a little bit muddied by the fact that at the same time, rather more quietly, the U.S. sent troops to Saudi Arabia. So it is not the case that the administration is simply pulling bring everybody back that America has deployed all over the world. This seems to have been a selective and a quite precipitous action. That's the other thing, is that even the Pentagon was not prepared for this decision that the president suddenly took. And so it raises questions not only about the consistency and weight of America's word in negotiations with other countries, or the extent to which our allies can depend on us, but also about the processes through which these decisions are being made, and whether everybody in the American government is on the same page.
Yeah, but clearly everybody in the government is not on the same page. And you know, that's what I want to go to you next for that, Tom, because at a time when the president is under some duress on other fronts, other political fronts, some of his staunchest allies are not backing him and, in fact, vehemently opposing him on this strategy.
Notably, Senator Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who thinks this is a really bad idea. I would just follow on what Molly said. The Pentagon is now saying, well, we were consulted. What they're not saying is that they oppose this. Pentagon opposed it, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs opposed it, the Secretary of Defense opposed it, and Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, all thought that the total withdrawal of U.S. troops from this region was a very bad idea, and the president said, in effect, I am the commander-in-chief.
Have we heard of one person who said that it is a good idea other than the president himself?
No, I haven't. And, of course, the reaction from American allies around the world, especially in Europe and Asia, has been uniformly skeptical. As I said, it's a rare unifying instance in Washington where a president has done something that everybody seems to think was a bad idea.
It's interesting, with everything that's happened over the course of the last 2.5 years, and you talk about a unifying principle. Yes, this seems to be something that both sides of the aisle can agree is questionable at best as a policy. And I thought of one person, which is Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, who does not think that U.S. troops should be anywhere outside the borders of the United States. But that's a longer story for another day. Let's talk about the rest of the world. What's the feeling in the rest of the world, Molly, about this particular action? What has been the reaction from world leaders? I tend to feel that it's been rather muted. We haven't had a lot of direct comment on this, but certainly there's a clear message being sent to any current or potential ally of the United States about what the word of the U.S. means in terms of any military or diplomatic agreement.
I think that's correct, although I would say that that's been called into question many times over the past couple of years because the president's approach to foreign policy has been so inconsistent. I mean, from the very beginning, he has even had our allies in NATO wondering whether the United States will abide by our treaty commitments to that organization. So a lot of America's traditional allies have spent the last couple of years wondering if the U.S. can still be counted on in the ways that we were dependent on before. But I do think that this ups the ante when it comes to the erratic and inconsistent foreign policy that President Trump has pursued. And it means that you hear critics of the president saying there could be lasting effects of this type of action, in that long after Donald Trump is no longer president of the United States, countries around the world will be hesitant to enter into agreements with the U.S., wondering if actions like this could be suddenly taken.
Tom, we'll finish with you on this one. Is a reversal of this policy possible? Is there a possibility that such a violent situation, such a horrific humanitarian or military situation develops that we end up having to send troops back, or would the administration just simply refuse to acknowledge it?
I think that's unlikely, Michael, because that would be the president in effect admitting a mistake. And that's one of many things we've learned about the president, is when there is a mistake, it's always somebody else's fault. And he's very reluctant to take personal responsibility, even on small things where he could have just said in another context, I misspoke. It's not what I meant. But in this case, he's reluctant to do that. So the notion that he's going to reverse course and send American troops back in there, I think, would be surprising to me.
In a week of stunning quotes, one that stood out to me recently was the president in a stand-up in the last couple of days saying that what Turkey is getting now is they're not going to have to kill millions of people. This was one that gave me chills. And I hope that the situation doesn't evolve into the violent situation that appears to be headed towards.
He also said there's a lot of sand in that part of the world. They can play in that sand. Not exactly the most diplomatic thing you'd wish to hear.
Again, a week of stunning statements. Let's move on very quickly to the impeachment inquiry. Again, it's only been a couple of weeks since we had a whistleblower come forward with information about a call where there was a allegation of President Trump seeking political favors from the Ukraine in exchange for funding that had already been approved to Ukraine. Now it seems like, again, we're getting weeks worth of information every hour. Since the news is so dense, I'd like to just try to, in this limited time we have, have sort of touch on the significant individuals for the people who don't follow this as closely as we do in the audience, get to the key moments and maybe a couple of predictions, our crystal ball for what we think is going to happen next. Molly, I'll start with you. We had so much testimony in this past week, and you had the fired U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. You had Fiona Hill, who was formerly of the National Security Council. You had Gordon Sondland, who is the current U.S. ambassador to the EU. So much testimony, so many quotes. What stood out for you in this week of stunning testimony?
As you mentioned, this inquiry was all kicked off with the revelation of a whistleblower who was concerned about a call between President Trump and the president of Ukraine, President Zelensky. But I think what we have learned and what all of the testimonials that you referenced have in common is that this is a much bigger deal than a single phone call. And the picture that's been painted this week is of not just one phone call that alarmed some people inside the White House and the foreign policy apparatus, but a much broader concern over a shadow foreign policy that was being pursued by a few of the president's allies who had gone outside the normal channels, who were not necessarily looping in the State Department, and who were pursuing potentially their own goals rather than American national security and foreign policy interests. And so this one phone call has picked up a sort of corner of the rug on this scandal, but it's turning out to be a much bigger story. And so you had Yovanovitch, the former ambassador to Ukraine, talking about the ways that she was subverted and eventually pushed out of her position for questioning what the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and others were doing here. You had Gordon Sondland, who was the EU ambassador, talking about how the president had personally called upon him to get involved and to manage this, even though it was not part of his normal area. And so all of this testimony has been behind closed doors. We're hearing bits and pieces of it that's leaked out or that's been released in statements. But what's coming together very quickly is a broad picture of what Democrats say were lawless actions by the administration in this part of the world.
Tom, I want to get your take on this, but we're going to stop right here and take a quick break, and we'll be back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine. And our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. Tom, as I always call you, our historian here on Issues in the News, you've seen a lot. And the phrase that came to my mind this week was all the president's men. And the other phrase that was given to us was the three amigos. And just talk about this range of characters that seem to have been lined up to set this shadow foreign policy in place. We've had so much testimony, so much admission, so many people are willing to step forward to talk. Again, when you look at the characters, who are some of the key players for you in their roles?
The prime figure beyond the president, of course, is the former mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani, one of the president's personal attorneys who has been intimately involved in the policy toward Ukraine. It's become clear from testimony that he was tasked by the president to get the Ukraine government to investigate Joe Biden and his son, Hunter Biden, to investigate alleged corruption. And the president and his advisors have said there was no quid pro quo. But there's testimony that continues to be documented that the president personally withheld almost $400 million in military and foreign aid to Ukraine until he could get an agreement for the government of Ukraine to look into alleged democratic corruption. The president says no quid pro quo, but in an extraordinary press conference the other day in the White House briefing room, Mick Mulvaney, who's the acting White House chief of staff, basically said, yeah, this kind of thing happens all the time. And he said, get over it. Politics gets involved in diplomacy. Well, there was a furor, to put it mildly, and by the end of the day, he'd had to put out one of those what I really meant. And he blamed it all on the media for misconstruing his remarks, but he was pretty clear. Once again, you have a senior official of the government in trouble for speaking the truth, perhaps.
I want to go to you with that one, because that press conference, to watch that, was almost surreal, to have someone in front of a microphone admit everything that the entire administration has been denying for 3 weeks. Just your thoughts on Mick Mulvaney in that press conference. happened?
Well, you had to feel a little bit sorry for the guy because he clearly had an impossible task. The administration sent him out there to answer questions, and people have a lot of questions about this. There's a whole impeachment inquiry going on to try to get to the bottom of what happened here. And we've seen the president repeatedly do this when he's accused of something. He'll deny it for a while, and then he'll admit it but claim that nothing was wrong with it. So that seems to be where this is all headed. In addition to the seeming admission of the quid pro quo, another remarkable statement that Mulvaney made was to say, well, there can't be a cover-up because, see, we're telling you everything. And so the administration now is saying, well, there couldn't have been anything wrong with what we did because we admitted what we did, and we wouldn't have done that if we'd done anything wrong. Now, the whistleblower complaint, there was an attempt by the administration to suppress not only the call itself, which was placed in some kind of special secret system where they've apparently been putting the evidence of interactions like this that the president has had. And we don't know how many other phone calls there are in that category. And then there was also an attempt seemingly to suppress the whistleblower complaint, right, which legally is required to go to Congress, but which the White House tried to stifle at first. But beyond that, there's a very interesting and difficult tack being taken by the administration to say that this thing that they denied for so long and are continuing to deny at the same time to say, if we did do that, it would have been fine. Right. Now, I do think, in fairness to Mulvaney, the existence of a quid pro quo is not the scandal here. He is correct to say that conditions are placed on foreign aid all the time. It is not uncommon for the government to say, we'll give you this aid if you do X. The problem is what the X was. Exactly. And that was a couple of politically motivated investigations, both of them, by the way, based on insane conspiracy theories that are not true. And the one that seems to have actually been more important to the president than the Hunter Biden dealings is this idea that it was somehow was the Ukrainians and not the Russians that were responsible for the cyber attacks in 2016 that affected the presidential election. And although it has been very solidly established by many, many investigators in the intelligence community that this was something that Russia did, President Trump and Rudy Giuliani continue to believe that somehow it was the Ukrainians who did it and that there's a server being hidden somewhere. And that seems to have been what was the primary concern and the primary demand for an investigation.
Tom, I'm going to get to you about the broader implications of this thing, because again, in a week of studying comments where you had John Bolton being revealed to say, I don't want any part of this drug deal, as he characterized this foreign policy, just some stunning testimony here and statements. But the public opinion on this thing, because when you look at polls, you wonder, what does this matter? How is this going to play out? Because you have one poll that says 53% of Americans want the president impeached and removed. And at the same time, there are models that just came out yesterday that show, from a major polling site, that showed Trump having several paths to win the election, if it was held right now, by a landslide. Where is the public on this?
Remains to be determined where the public is. I mean, I think to be determined by events that are at the moment unknown. Things always happen in campaigns. I mean, I think there is a contradiction here between these numbers. I mean, I don't think the president's going to win by a landslide, but he certainly could win. And so it's really hard to know exactly where this sorts out. I don't think he's in the best position of his administration. His numbers are low. His disapproval remains about 10 points higher than his approval. It's too early to know what issues, if anything, is going to really move the needle when people go to the polls.
Well, we could do a whole show on this one subject alone, but I will finish this particular section by saying that the way I feel that this is different is that this sort of starts and ends with the president himself and a phone call that he made and things that he said and initiatives that he has clearly directed by the testimony of many. So I think that it starts and ends in a different place, and we'll see exactly. Let's move on to U.S. debates. Senator Elizabeth Warren, the new frontrunner, it appears, in the campaign for the 2020 Democratic nomination, is feeling the pressure that you feel when you are the frontrunner. In the latest debates, she came under attack from virtually every other candidate on the stage, especially from those whose views are more centrist, I felt like. Molly, I'm sure you had a chance to watch the debates. Who do you think were the winners and losers at that particular debate?
Well, it was a very interesting debate because of the dynamic that you mentioned with the moderate candidates seeking to get a foothold. And I think the reason for that is that Joe Biden, former vice president, has been the frontrunner since this campaign began, and it seemed to have that moderate lane all to himself. So now that he seems to be faltering, and now that in several polls, Elizabeth Warren has passed him, both nationally and in the earliest states, notably Iowa and New Hampshire, now that that's happening, it seems to open up that moderate centrist sort of mainstream Democrat lane. And so you have other candidates not going after Biden to establish themselves there, but going after Warren to establish themselves in the position that Biden, I think, has had so far, which is as the sort of counterpoint to the liberalism of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders.
Biden, though, is slipping clearly in the polls. Tom, does that mean that the Ukraine strategy of President Trump actually did work, for better or worse? It may be to his own personal detriment. Did it work?
I don't think it worked, although I think it has taken a bite out of Biden. It's put him and his son on the defensive. So it probably has worked to a limited extent. The problem is Joe Biden keeps talking about the past, and he doesn't seem to have much of a blueprint for the future. I mean, his friends, his supporters say he's lying low. He's still the most well-known Democrat. He's still the most popular Democrat, and he's going to win big in South Carolina, which is the third really big primary next year after the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary, and he will emerge.
The one question that I came out from the whole evening was, really, should the Democrats even be having this many debates and this early? It seems like there's an opportunity for them to form this circular firing squad, and I wonder if that's, in a sense, what could be happening in a way. Are they damaging each and every candidate as they try to raise one?
As a journalist, I have to say, I'm always in favor of debates. I'm always in favor of the candidates being in settings where they can have discussions. And these debates have been quite substantive. They've focused almost entirely on policy issues and not on, you know, on personal sniping.
Let's move on to Brexit. I have a few subjects I want to hit very quickly, maybe 1 or 2 minutes each, as we closed up for this week. Leaders from the European Union say they have reached an agreement on a Brexit deal. Either one, I'll throw this out to you. The differences between the deal that we have now and the deal that was brokered by Theresa May, and why does anyone think this has a better chance of succeeding?
Because there needs to be a deal somehow or another, and I think there seems to be a breakthrough on the sticking point of the border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, which is part of the EU. That seems to have been resolved.
If it doesn't pass, is this the end of Boris Johnson?
Probably.
I would agree with that. Moving very quickly to the G7, the Trump administration has announced that they will hold the G7 summit in 2020 at Trump Doral, one of the president's own properties. Again, start with you, Tom. What do you think of that one?
Well, not the smartest thing they've probably done, but anybody who's been listening to all of this cannot be surprised. The president has been dropping hints about how wonderful Doral would be for the venue for the G7 summit. It's also very clear, because he's made it very clear, that he doesn't feel beholden to any sense of conflict of interest here. He's basically ordering the United States government to issue contracts to him, to a property that he owns, and so probably not the smartest image thing to have done.
Tom raises the question, Molly, does anybody care? And if they do, is there anything they can do about it?
I think there's a lot of evidence that people care. And when you look at polls about why it is that the president is disapproved of by a majority of Americans, the concern about corruption is relatively high on the list. It is, unlike perhaps the Mueller investigation, a relatively easy thing for people to grasp, this idea that the president puts his own interest above the national interest. And I think that is a big part of the message that Democrats are pushing in the impeachment inquiry as well.
As we close, we just want to remember U.S. Congressman Elijah Cummings, a much loved and respected public servant and a key figure in the ongoing impeachment inquiry that's going on in the House of Representatives. He died this week at the age of 68. Very quickly, I think you two probably both had interactions with him at some point. Tom, just a quick thought.
Yeah, I think he was an iconic figure, and he was far too liberal for the Republicans who support the president. But one perfect indicator of the respect he commanded on both sides of the aisle is that Mark Meadows, the ranking Republican on Cummings's committee, was very close. They were very close. And the fact that he commanded such respect from Republicans who often would bash him for his political views and his opposition to President Trump still were shocked and devastated and saddened by his passing, I think, is a testimonial to who he really was.
Molly, your thoughts on Congressman Cummings?
You heard a lot of his colleagues refer to Congressman Cummings, Chairman Cummings, as a North Star in their remembrances of him, because he was known for a sense of moral clarity, for a voice that was powerful not only as an orator, but as Tom mentioned, he was the chairman of the Oversight Committee, which is the committee that is charged with holding the presidential administration and other parts of the government accountable. He was known as a meticulous investigator, a tough questioner, and also a mentor. mentor to a lot of younger members of Congress who he put on the committee and gave opportunities and held to high standards. So you've heard a lot of great affection for Congressman Cummings in the last couple of days.
He will be remembered and he will be missed. That's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine. This program is produced by VOA's Kim Lewis. Our engineer is Joe Gill, and I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.